Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia?
Yes, indeed, we're gonna have a Solartopia. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger and with David Burns and the Rivertown Kids on the Grammy Award-winning Tomorrow's Children. From Appleseed Records, as a matter of fact. So, back today for another hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Our guest we're waiting for on the call is Gordon Edwards, from Canada, and he is on with us. I'm gonna start right in with our guest, Gordon. You there?
Yes, I'm here.
And you're talking just from Montreal, is that right, Gordon?
That's correct.
Alright, so, usually I start off with a little discussion on my own of nuclear power, but you are, as far as I can tell, Canada's leading expert on nuclear power. I read your stuff all the time. You're terrific. Just watched you on TV the other day, actually. You're wearing a flower in your lapel. Are you still wearing a flower in your lapel?
Well, yeah, actually, that's actually made from sealskin. It was given to me by an Inuit woman up in Iqaluit when I was talking about uranium mining up there. She fabricated it right sitting in the front row and pinned it on me right after the talk, and I've never removed it since then.
Well, good for you. And unfortunately, we're going to have to start with the bad news. I usually like to start a little upbeat, but the truly terrifying news from Fukushima. I posted a piece, a progressive magazine on August 8th. It's made the rounds of Common Dreams, reader-supported news, a few other the websites, freepress.org. You, of course, have been talking about what's happening in Fukushima. It is not a pretty picture. I think I'll let you, if you don't mind, jump in and explain the latest developments to our horrified, terrified, and deeply saddened listeners. So jump right in, Gordon, and give us a shot here of what's going on there.
Okay, Harvey. Well, as your listeners may or may not understand, a nuclear reactor can't really be shut off. Even after the reaction itself is stopped, that is the chain reaction, the radioactivity that has been created during the chain reaction lasts for millions of years, but it continues to generate an awful lot of heat for the first 10 or 20 years. And when they take the fuel out of the reactor, or whether it's in the reactor or out of the reactor, it has to be actively cooled for at least 7 years before it is put into dry storage, because otherwise, if it's not continuously cooled, it will overheat. And when it overheats, it's going to give off radioactive material into the environment and into the atmosphere, as well as into the soil. So this is the problem with the Fukushima reactors. Even though they melted down 2.5 years ago, TEPCO still has to pump water into the melted cores of those reactors every single day, and try and pump it back out again and store it above ground. They've got thousands of tanks that they've built above ground, and they're running out of space. They even had to cut down a small forest in order to make more room for these tanks, above ground tanks, that they're using to hold the contaminated water.
Well, Gordon, let me clarify one thing here. At Fukushima on March 11, 2011, we have, of course, a major incident with a tsunami and an earthquake, and in the wake of that, we had at least three meltdowns.
That's correct.
And you have just explained that these cores, the melted cores, have to be cooled, but we don't even know where these cores are, do we?
No,
that's a really amazing situation.
That's correct. And what's happening is that how far these cores have penetrated through the floor of the reactor building or not is really unknown, because the radiation levels are so intense that not only can humans not go in there, no humans have been able to get close to these melted cores. The radioactivity is too intense. But even robots that they've sent in there, the gamma radiation is so intense that it fries the electronic components after a few minutes. And so the robots are of only very limited use for a short time. The result is that they just don't know what the state is. But we believe that the molten core has melted through the bottom of the containment vessel. It's onto the floor, and it's probably either melted through the floor or is in the process of melting through the floor. The fact that
this is times three. This is not just one. This is unit 1, 2, and 3.
That's correct. Units 1, 2, and 3. Now, some of those units are perhaps in a worse condition than others. Unit 1 seems to be the one that melted down first, although we can't be 100% sure even of that. But in the case of Unit 1, there was, in addition to the loss of power, you see, what happens with the loss of power is that you lose the circulation of the water. When you lose the circulation of the water, even though the reaction is shut off and the chain reaction is stopped, the radioactivity alone is enough to drive the temperature higher and higher until it melts at a temperature of above 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's what happened to all three of those cores.
Now, Gordon Edwards, do we know, is there any blob of corium, because that's what we call the core once it melts, corium, that is still at 5,000 degrees? Is it centigrade or Fahrenheit?
That would be Fahrenheit. I'm using Fahrenheit because I assume most of your listeners are American.
It's
about 2,800 degrees Celsius.
Any of the corium at Fukushima still at 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit?
Well, it's conceivable there is. It's impossible to know for sure because, you see, when there's a difference between heat and temperature, which people don't always understand. Temperature is how hot something is, but heat is a form of energy, and if you're adding energy, if you're adding heat, then if that heat cannot escape, if there's no way for the heat to be removed, then the temperature will go up and up and up. There's no limit to how high the temperature can go if the heat isn't removed. Now, the heat can be removed by various ways, by conduction, by convection, by active cooling. It's possible that inside the corium, the melted mass, there could be pockets of corium which are still in a molten state. We don't know that for sure.
And this is 2.5 years later. Now, we did have a bad indicator this year, in that some steam has been observed on the site, and that would be an indicator that we still have super hot material at Fukushima. Is that correct?
That's right. And in fact, there's been several incidents of steam escaping, and nobody quite understands what's going on because, again, we're playing a game of blind man's bluff. Again, people should remember that at Three Mile Island, when the 1979 accident occurred, it was only a partial core meltdown there, but it was 6 years before anybody could take a look at it. It was 6 years before they could take the lid off the reactor and actually look down into it and see just the extent of the damage.
Yeah, and the core at Three Mile Island, the structure at Three Mile Island was nowhere near as wrecked, as it is at Fukushima. There was, thank God, we were on the brink of an explosion at Three Mile Island, which never thankfully happened. Certainly the elements were there. There was plenty of hydrogen around, which could have exploded.
Well, there were hydrogen explosions. Yeah, there were a couple of hydrogen explosions at Three Mile Island, but not powerful enough to blow the machinery to kingdom come.
Right, and that's what's happened at Fukushima times three, possibly even times four. I mean, we've had major damage in Unit 4 as well. Nobody knows. There's no agreement on exactly how the damage happened at Unit 4. The reactor was shut, thankfully, at the time of the tsunami and earthquake. There's been very substantial structural damage at Unit 4.
Terrific structural damage, yeah. Now, what they've discovered recently, Harvey, as you understand probably, is that while TEPCO has been pumping water into the molten cores and trying to pump it back out again and store it on the surface, there is at the same time an underground river of groundwater which is coming down from the high ground behind the plant and running underground through the damaged reactor buildings, right through the molten core of the reactors, and flushing out those radioactive materials and carrying them through underground toward the sea. And this has been going into the sea at the rate of at least 300 tons per day. That's about 80,000 gallons a day, or 3,300 gallons per hour. And this stuff is very radioactive. It's intensely radioactive, and it contains a mixture of all those fission products, all those radioactive byproducts that have been produced by the fission process. And that's been going into the sea probably ever since the accident occurred 2.5
right.
years ago.
And TEPCO has not talked about this. It's really just, shall we say, surfaced in the media that this huge river. I mean, there is, my understanding also is there's an aquifer under Fukushima.
Oh, there is, absolutely. Yeah,
it's never been discussed. I'm sure it's totally contaminated. It has to be totally contaminated.
Well, it is. It is. In fact, they have these trenches that they built around the reactor. They have numerous trenches. Some of these trenches were used to carry cables. Some of these trenches were used to carry pipes. But in these trenches around Unit 2 and Unit 1, they have found levels of cesium-134. Now, cesium-134 is radioactive, one form of radioactive cesium. The permissible level of this is supposed to be 60 becquerels per liter. Now, a becquerel is one disintegration per second. So 60 becquerels per liter is the maximum permissible in water. They measured 750 million becquerels per liter in the water in those trenches. And for cesium-137, where the permissible level is 90 becquerels per liter, they've measured 1.7 billion becquerels per liter. So these trenches, the levels of contamination are extremely high.
Yeah, I mean, in a real world where we don't have this kind of disaster, nobody should be anywhere near that site. And
that's for sure.
It's covered with workers.
There was recently a story just a matter of less than 12 or so hours ago where 10 workers were sprayed with water, presumably to cool them off or to wash the dust off them. And the water itself was so radioactive that now those 10 workers are going to have to be submitted to body scans to find out what kind of internal contamination they might have experienced. So once the water is contaminated, you have the drinking water, you have the water that you wash with, you have even the water you wash the clothes with. Everything becomes suspect. And water, of course, is the lifeblood of living organisms. You know, it's you could think of the aquifers and the rivers as being like the bloodstream of the world of living things. And once that's contaminated, you're really in trouble.
Yes, and you know, they're telling us that the Pacific Ocean is so large, it's not going to, you know, it'll diffuse all this stuff, and it's absolute nonsense. And we have strontium 90, we have cesium-134, cesium-137. Iodine-131, these all have half-lives in the 30-year range, and there's plenty of other, some of them do, and go ahead, you were going to correct
me. Yeah, well, iodine-131 is only got a half-life of 8 days. However, iodine-129, which has the same characteristics as iodine-131, has a half-life of 17 million years. So, again, you have a wide variety of materials. There's other materials like the so-called actinides, plutonium and americium and curium, which typically have half-lives in the tens of thousands of years. So once these things are disseminated into the environment, they become part of the food chain. And because we have evolved in an environment where the level of radioactivity was relatively constant all the way along, our bodies do not have any mechanisms for determining radioactivity. So the bodies of fish, the bodies of other animals, they just treat this stuff as if it's food, and they store it up in their bodies, and of course it goes up and magnifies as it goes up the food chain in the case of some of these materials, such as cesium, because cesium is regarded by the body as if it's a valuable nutrient. And they found fish, for example, that have 2,000 times the permissible levels, the so-called permissible levels, which are really the maximum contamination levels, of radioactivity, they found fish with 2,000 times that amount in their flesh right in the harbor near Fukushima.
And, of course, our own federal Food and Drug Administration ceased testing Pacific fish in the wake of the Fukushima accident. You would think that any sane society would vastly escalate the testing of fish coming out of the Pacific Ocean. But our FDA, I don't know about the Canadian one, but our FDA stopped testing fish after Fukushima. I mean, it's staggering that they did this. And, of course, our president got on national television within a week of the accident and said the radiation was not going to come here. And when he was on TV saying it, it had already come here by airborne. In fact, radiation from Chernobyl got to the United States within 2 weeks. It was very, very substantially detectable, as has been the stuff from Fukushima. But our federal government, I'm not sure about the Canadian one, Gordon Edwards,
They've also stopped monitoring. It's not only a non-scientific, but it's an anti-scientific point of view. You would think that, you know, if you really wanted to find out the effects of radioactivity on the food chain, you would pull out all the stops in studying and measuring every last detail in order to learn. But the government seemed to be more interested in turning a blind eye to it. They're more interested in public relations than they are in protection. Or even in learning.
Nuclear industry.
That's right. They're protecting the nuclear industry rather than the population. Now, in fact, this is what the Diet of Japan found when they hired, they commissioned a panel of experts to write a report on the causes of the Fukushima accident. And they determined that the Fukushima accident was largely a man-made disaster due to collusion between the industry and the regulator and the government, because they were more concerned about promoting the good image of nuclear power and the public relations aspects of the situation rather than protecting people or the environment.
I don't know if we could ever get a report like that out of the United States, frankly, or that was so frank. I'm glad to hear that the Japanese at least faced up to the reality.
Well, some are and some aren't. The difficulty is that the nuclear industry is almost like the medieval church, you know. It's a state within a state, and they run their own affairs with very minimal or no interference from the governments, respectively. And this is one of the problems. You know, our elected officials, they don't deal with these questions, even though they're life and death issues, to a sufficient degree. The result is that the nuclear industry is basically largely a self-regulating industry. Both in the United States and in Canada, the regulators are captives of the nuclear industry. They are staffed by the people who come from the nuclear industry, and they have very similar attitudes to those in the nuclear industry. And the idea is to, whatever you do, don't stop nuclear power, just try and expand it, taking precautions as you go along, but don't let anything stop you. And that's really right. The attitude of the International Atomic Energy Agency as well. Most people don't realize, if you read the mandate of the International Atomic Energy Agency, their mandate is to expand nuclear power.
Right. Now, the IAEA, which you've mentioned, the International Atomic Energy is a body of the United Nations. Now, their mandate, as you say, is to both, so they don't really have regulatory power. They are out there to promote the nuclear power industry. In the United States, we have the Atomic Energy Commission. The Atomic Energy Commission was charged with both regulating and promoting the nuclear power industry, but in the 70s, the anti-nuclear movement rose up and demanded that there would be an independent regulator, so we wound up with the Energy Resource and Development Agency and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission was supposed to be an independent regulator, but Gordon, as you've mentioned, the regulators have been captured by the industry. We have, ironically, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff in the United States, the middle and lower ranking officials, are generally pretty professional. It's the commissioners themselves that are corrupted. We have some really horrible commissioners. We've had some terrible ones. We just had a guy who was the chair of the commission, Gregory Jasko, and he was actually pretty good. And they got, of course, they got rid of him.
As a matter of fact, Jasko, Jasko, after he was replaced as the chairman of the National Nuclear Regulatory Commission, he even said that there is a fundamental problem with all the nuclear reactors that are operating in the United States, and they should all be phased out. Because the problem is, the one that I identified earlier, the fact is that with a complete loss of power, which however that's brought about, whether it's brought about by warfare, whether it's brought about by natural disaster, whether it's brought about by sabotage, if you have a complete loss of on-site and off-site power, you have a catastrophe. Because those Fukushima reactors, when you see the enormous damage that's been done to the buildings that you described earlier, that's not damage from the earthquake or from the tsunami. That's self-inflicted damage by the reactors themselves. All you got to do is cut off the power, both on-site and off-site power, and the same thing would happen with other reactors around the world.
Yeah, it's horrifying. We're talking with Gordon Edwards. Gordon is the, as far as I'm concerned, the leading expert on nuclear power in Canada, one of the world's truly most knowledgeable people of all about nuclear power. I read everything he writes. Gordon, if you'll identify yourself with a book or a website that you'd like people to go to, please
right.
do.
Yeah, the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility was formed about 40 years ago, and we have a website which is CCNR, Charles Charles Norman Roger, .org. So CCNR.org, and it's got things both on weapons and on plutonium and on reactor safety, on uranium mining, on radiation effects, on isotope production, all these things.
Now, do you have a title associated with this organization, Gordon?
I'm the president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility.
Okay, and you are the leading organization in Canada on nuclear power, and or against nuclear power, and I watch all your stuff, just watch you on TV. Talking about Fukushima. The reason we're talking about Fukushima today, folks, here at the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, is a shocking revelation has come, which has probably been hidden for more than 2 years, which is that massive, massive quantities of radioactive contaminated water have been pouring in to the Pacific Ocean. This is not inconsequential stuff. Not only are they massive quantities of liquids, but they are very highly contaminated. You know, we've heard a lot about tritium, which has an 8-day half-life, but and generally the public has been led to believe that the effluent from the Fukushima site has been largely tritium, which is serious, but with an 8-day half-life, you're not going to take it too seriously. But
excuse me, just a correction. Tritium has a 12.3-year half-life, so it's dangerous for about 100 years or so at least. You know, we're talking about centuries for tritium. We're talking about probably a millennium or so for strontium and cesium. And we're talking about basically hundreds of thousands of years for things like plutonium.
The tritium, I guess they confused it with iodine-131, which has an 8-day half-life.
That's right.
Okay.
So, tritium is a rather different substance. It's an insidious substance. On the one hand, the industry regards it as one of the least dangerous radioactive materials because it gives off a very weak beta particle when it disintegrates. When radioactive materials disintegrate, they give off subatomic shrapnel in the form of particles and gamma rays. But tritium does not give off any gamma radiation. It only gives off a low-energy beta particle. But the problem with tritium is it's exactly like ordinary hydrogen. It's radioactive hydrogen. And hydrogen is not only the basis for water, H2O, but it's also the basis for all the organic molecules in living things. So that tritium, radioactive hydrogen, gets incorporated right into DNA molecules and into all the other organic molecules in your body. And because of its strategic location in these molecules, the damage that it can do is extraordinary.
Well, tell us, Gordon Edwards, and, you know, the Pacific Ocean is really big, and this is coming into the Pacific Ocean, although I guess they have a bay there outside of Fukushima. Is there a danger to the west coast of Canada and the United States from the effluent coming from Fukushima into the ocean?
Well, there is, but one doesn't want to exaggerate it too much because the ocean is enormous, and even the tonnage of living material in the ocean is enormous. But the fact of the matter is that you know, when we think about putting something into the ocean, we think of it dispersing and diluting and getting weaker and weaker just as a result of mixing with all those huge volumes of water. But living organisms go around and they gather this stuff up and they reconcentrate it in their bodies. And so the fish and the other living organisms are the ones who are collecting and absorbing this material. Typically, you will see concentrations in algae, for example, or seaweed, which are tens or even hundreds of thousands of times higher. The concentrations of radioactive materials in those materials are 10 to 100,000 times higher than they are in the water itself. Then you have organisms which eat those other organisms, and they concentrate it even further in their flesh. So the result is that as you go up the food chain, these living organisms become carriers for the radioactive materials and concentrators of the radioactive materials. And the result is that over a period of time, as the fish get older, they eat more and more of this material, and the concentrations get larger and larger in their bodies. So one would expect that fish near the Japanese coast, for example, if they don't swim too far away from the Japanese coast, they're probably going to be getting more and more concentration in their flesh as the time goes by. Even though the accident itself were contained, suppose there was no effluent going into the ocean, there still is enough in there already that they're going to be gathering it up for years to come.
Well, we have, I believe it was cesium that was found in tuna off the coast of California, and the cesium was traced to Fukushima. Is that credible?
Yes, that is credible. Where the real debate comes in here is how life-threatening is it? The fact of the matter is that at low levels of exposure, and this is why there's a lot of controversy, at low levels of exposure to radioactivity, people do not get immediately sick. For this reason, Rosalie Bertell wrote a book called No Immediate Danger, and it was an ironic title, because the fact is there is no immediate danger. You're not going to keel over dead, just like people do not keel over dead from smoking a cigarette. Like, one of the reasons why the dangers of cigarettes went unnoticed for such a long time is that the people who smoke cigarettes look like they were having a good time. They seemed healthy. They seemed beautiful. And it's only when 10, 20, 30 years later that they die of lung cancer and emphysema and heart disease and strokes. And unless you follow the medical records, you don't even see the damage that's being done microscopically. Well, it's the same thing with radioactivity. The damage that is done at a microscopic and a cellular level. And it takes biological reproduction of those cells that turns into cancer and other types of diseases.
Of course, the analogy goes a little beyond that, Gordon Edwards. My understanding is that actually some of the damage that comes from most cigarettes, because they use phosphates in the fertilization of tobacco, actually is radioactive damage.
Well, indeed. In fact, the American Health Society, which is the society that actually works for the nuclear industry mostly, the American Health Physics Society, which is these are the people who work at the nuclear plants and so on, they have said that up to 90% of the deaths attributed to cigarette smoking are actually due to radioactivity in the tobacco in the form of a substance called polonium-210. And this polonium-210 is what causes most of the cancer and also causes most of the heart disease that is experienced by smokers. So,
right, and briefly, polonium-210 is, my understanding, is an alpha emitter. It emits particles that
right.
are two neutrons and two protons, of which
that's
like
correct.
A giant cannonball. And once it's inside your lung, your chances of getting cancer are about 100%.
Depending on the levels. Now, the levels in cigarette smoke are extremely small. They're extremely minute. But polonium-210, I mean, really, I don't know. This is a little bit off topic, but maybe not. Because polonium-210 was the material that was used to murder Alexander Litvinenko in London, England, by putting a little bit in his tea. If people may remember, he died over a period of about 30 days, excruciating death drinking radioactively contaminated tea. It was murder.
Which many people, unfortunately, will be experiencing over a long period of time with the emissions from Fukushima. We're talking with Gordon Edwards, one of the leading experts, the leading expert on nuclear power in Canada. I've got him on because we have terrible revelations. I've got an article at the Progressive magazine, and other websites, Common Dreams, around the web about the latest revelations of massive quantities of radioactive liquid flowing through the Fukushima site. We're going to take a 3-minute break here, Gordon. Hear the same song from Dana Lyons on Solartopia. Back after a few announcements. And we're going to talk about small modulated reactors and thorium reactors in the second half of the show. I'm honored to have you on, Gordon. You're an excellent guest, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia. It's time to get a better plan. Solartopia.
Okay, we are back. This is Harvey Wasserman with Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you, Dana Lyons of Cows with Guns fame for the that Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. Talking with Gordon Edwards, the leading expert in nuclear power from Canada, about recent horrifying developments at Fukushima. I got to tell you, this stuff makes me physically ill when I write about it, when I read it. It's just, my problem is that I spent a week, 2 weeks, 10 days, I don't remember exactly, in central Pennsylvania a year after the accident, investigating the claim that no one was killed there. And by God, it's the biggest lie told in American industrial history. There were many, 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 many people killed at Three Mile Island from the radiation. Afterwards, I interviewed their families. We took our own epidemiological tests. Anybody tells you no one was killed at Three Mile Island, they are telling a horrible lie. Gordon Edwards, let's very quickly, I want to run through the mechanics of a little bit of Fukushima. Unit 1, which exploded, of course, was General Electric designed. Units 2 and 3, were they also designed by General Electric?
Well, basically it was the same design, although some of them were built by a Japanese company, they were still the American design that was used. They were all the American design. And they all had the spent fuel pool high up, so that, the worry with unit number 4 is that even though there was no fuel in the core of the reactor, there's a spent fuel pool very precariously perched up about 5 floors. And if the plant were to collapse, which is showing signs of doing, then that fuel would be all over the place, and it would be impossible to cool, and that would be a real, you could get far greater emissions than we did initially.
Well, tell us what would happen exactly if the, as best we can guess, it's never happened, thankfully, and tell us what would happen if the spent fuel pool at Unit 4 did come tumbling down. Now, as you say, was there no core? Was there no fuel in the core, or was it just shut down?
There was no fuel in the core at all. All the fuel had been taken out and put into the spent fuel pool. Nevertheless, the emissions from Unit 4 were among the highest from all 4 reactors, and the reason for that was because of the spent fuel pool.
Okay, so, I mean, it's surreal to describe this, but we have a spent fuel pool, which must weigh many, 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 many tons. Minus thing is we have about 1,300 tons of fuel. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right. And the difficulty is that they can't even lift that fuel out of the pool because the structure has been so damaged that the cranes have been destroyed that are usually used to lift the material. So they have to build a whole new infrastructure over the top of the damaged reactor building in order to support a crane that will be able to lift the fuel out of the pool. It can't be lifted out without its own cooling system. So you have to have special casks that have their own cooling system. Otherwise, that fuel will, again, overheat in the air and will release radioactive materials into the air.
And,
so
and the genius,
it's a real problem.
The
They're not even going to start moving the fuel out of the pool for another year or so.
If they figure out how. And we don't even
if they figure out how, that's right.
Right. It's never been done before.
No.
And the part of the problem is that the spent fuel rods, now these rods are, what are they, about 100 feet long? And they're not that long. And they're the size of, I guess, your thumb. I suppose, and they're in...
Well, they're in assemblies, though, and these assemblies are larger. These assemblies are sort of like two-by-fours, you might say. And they have to be... But when they're lifted out, they have to be supplied with their own system of cooling water circulating through the cast that lifts them out. And you also have to have a place to put them. So where are you going to put this stuff?
Right. And the fuel is clad in zirconium alloy, which will catch fire when it's exposed to air. How these geniuses built nuclear fuel rods and chose zirconium to clad them is staggeringly stupid.
Well, zirconium is the reason why they choose certain materials like zirconium is because of the neutron economy. Because in order to get the maximum benefit in terms of electricity out of the fuel, you want to make sure you have a material that doesn't absorb too many neutrons. Neutrons are what make the whole fission process work. So they choose zirconium for that reason. However, zirconium, as you say, is notoriously flammable at higher temperatures, and you can have a zirconium fire, which is far more intense than an ordinary fire. If some people may remember the old flash cubes that used to be used on cameras, and it would make a brilliant flash at the moment that you press the shutter to take the picture. Well, what made that brilliant flash was little shavings of zirconium in the flash cubes. So it's been well known from day one that zirconium is highly flammable, and it gives off a very bright, energetic combustion when ignited. Now, so what happens is that if the zirconium, if the fuel bundles are exposed to air in the pool, suppose the water were to drain out of the pool for one reason or another, then you would have the possibility of the temperature rising to the point where the zirconium would actually catch fire. And you'd have a very energetic fire in the pool, and this would just loft all kinds of radioactive material into the atmosphere.
It would clearly be the largest radiation in the history of the world. I mean, we have had, I think this was actually a year ago, it's been quite a while, quite many months ago, at least one Japanese scientist estimated that between 20 and 30 times more radiation has been released at Fukushima than was released at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And God forbid one of these spent fuel pools would be exposed to air. We can't even begin to calculate how much radiation will be released into the air. And, of course, it would be pitched pretty seriously high into the air by the fire. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Now, actually, higher in some ways may be better, but it goes further. That's the problem. Like at Chernobyl, they had a very intense fire, and what that does is that lofts the radioactivity higher into the air, which means it spreads over a much larger area. And so the result is that even in England, the sheep farmers in northern England, for 20 years after the Chernobyl accident, they couldn't sell their sheep, their lamb meat and their mutton, for human consumption without having very careful testing of the cesium levels in the sheep meat. And that was a result of Chernobyl, so that's thousands of kilometers away.
Yeah, of course it also came to the northern tier of North America, well north of north of central Ohio across, it definitely hit Chicago, I'm sure it blanketed Canada. The fallout from Chernobyl.
Well, it was measurable in the flesh of the Arctic caribou and in the flesh eaters, the Inuit, who eat a lot of caribou. You could really see a spike in their levels of cesium, radioactive cesium, in their food and also in their bodies.
And also in the milk in New England.
That's
right. Of course, the month after Chernobyl, this would be May of 1986, there was a 60% drop in bird births in the Point Reyes Station north of San Francisco. And the guy, the ranger, the park ranger who had been keeping the records of bird births at Point Reyes for 10 years. And then in May, the spring of 86, he recorded a 60% drop, and the response of the Park Service was to fire him.
Hmm.
You know, there have been rainstorms come down and brought the radiation from Chernobyl down on these birds in Newman, California. The park ranger, you know, just doing his job, reported the bird deaths, and they fired him. We're talking with Gordon Edwards, of one of the leading experts on radiation and health and nuclear power in Canada. Gordon, what is your website again?
CCNR.org.
Okay. So Gordon, we certainly could talk many more hours about this.
I just want to say one more thing about the underground leakage, this underground river that we talked about flowing through. The problem with this is that they don't really know how to stop it. They built a barrier, but the water just piles up behind the barrier. It's an underground barrier. And either the water is going to go around the ends of the barrier or it's going to go over the top of the barrier. And what has happened is the water level has climbed under the ground, and now it's gone over the top of the barrier. So that they really don't know how to stop this flow because it's a major aquifer. And one of the plans that they are talking about is freezing, making a kind of a ring of frozen ground, like a wall of ice around the entire four reactors. That would be about a mile. We're talking about a mile of a wall of ice, a mile long, to act as a barrier to prevent the groundwater from going into the cores of these damaged reactors in order to try and solve the problem. But this is, of course, not only is it sound like a crazy science fiction idea, it's going to cost a ton of money, and it's going to cost an awful lot of energy just to keep that ground frozen, and nobody knows if it's actually going to work. In fact, some of the experts in Japan have said that by diverting the groundwater around the sides of the building, you may weaken the soil to the point where the buildings themselves topple, and that could be a far worse problem. So they really don't know what they're doing. They literally don't know what they're doing.
And you have just quoted Dale Klein, a former U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner, who was hired to come out there and to Japan and consult. And he went public with a statement to TEPCO saying, quote, "You don't know what you're doing."
And precisely.
Even
the head of the new Japanese regulatory agency has said this is a real emergency, and that the TEPCO company has no sense of crisis. And as a result, the government of Japan has said that they are going to take direct control, direct charge of this problem of dealing with the gushing of this radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. But there's no guarantee that the government of Japan is going to do any better than TEPCO at stopping it, because it's a fundamental problem.
Right, and sooner or later the whole global community is going to have to step in. This is a global problem, ladies and gentlemen, and we're talking about radioactive water pouring into the Pacific Ocean with extremely lethal isotopes, strontium, cesium, iodine, tritium, that kill people, that completely contaminate all the living things in the ocean. The global community is going to have to step in. The global community has no better idea of what to do than TEPCO or the Japanese government, frankly.
Well, that's right. And if the Japanese government, this idea of having a global international task force to look at this has been suggested by myself and others from the very beginning of the Fukushima disaster, and the Japanese government has strongly resisted all efforts to do that. But I think it really requires pressure from other countries to say to Japan that this is not just a Japanese problem. This is a world problem.
But the problem is, then nobody has any answers. I mean, does anybody outside of Japan know anything better than anybody inside Japan?
I think that you're going to have a better chance of getting some reasonable ideas if you have people who are not connected to the nuclear industry, not connected to the International Atomic Energy Agency, not connected to governments that are promoting nuclear power even, but that are just independent scientists looking at the problem as an environmental problem, not as a nuclear problem. And I think that you may get at least some good ideas. One idea that's been suggested is to build the wall above ground, not only below ground, but above ground. And when the water pools up behind the wall, it will at least be be possible to pump it into tankers that could come and carry it to safe storage areas. When I say safe storage areas, I just mean places where you can keep it out of the environment of living things. There are various things that could be done that are better than what are being done now.
Well, of course, all those tankers are then going to become radioactive waste as well.
They are.
The guys who are running the tankers are going to be gonna have to wear radiation suits.
It's like the reverse Midas touch, you know. King Midas, everything he touched turned to gold. In the case of nuclear waste, everything nuclear waste touches turns to nuclear waste.
Well, this is more like the Medusa touch. In fact, I don't know,
not
to get too obscure, there was a devastatingly depressing movie with starring Richard Burton. I believe it was made in the early 60s, called The Medusa Touch. And this guy was a totally cursed piece of work. And the conclusion of that, well, I shouldn't ruin it for people, but it had to do with nuclear power. It had to do with wind scale. We're talking with Gordon Edwards, leading expert on nuclear power from Canada. The incredibly depressing developments at Fukushima, very, very dangerous. Of course, the Japanese government, the new administration there, has been pushing to reopen the 48 reactors that are shut in Japan right now. There are 50 still operable. They managed to open two of them. Very, very political, very highly resisted by the Japanese public. I don't know if this administration is continuing to push to open the other reactors in Japan in the light of this emergency of Fukushima. At least a few of the other reactors were owned by TEPCO. And you had a situation before this broke where TEPCO was simultaneously, you know, doing their wonders at Fukushima while politicking to open their other reactors. I mean, are you updated on what's happened with that?
It's the worst kind of government we could have. It's a very right-wing government, very pro-nuclear, and Abe is the prime minister, and he is determined to open more of these reactors. One has to remember that there were 54 nuclear reactors operating at the time of the Fukushima disaster, providing 30% of Japan's electricity. So for a while, they were all shut down, and now there's only two of them operating, and they want to get more of them started up, the Japanese government. But they are running into a lot of opposition. A very large majority of the Japanese public does not want to see the role of nuclear power expanded, but there is a softer number in terms of starting up some of the ones that already exist because of the economic repercussions. However, the mayor of Hiroshima recently came out publicly attacking the prime minister for not taking a stronger stance against nuclear weapons, because the nuclear weapons question is a very hot issue in Japan as well. And with North Korea having developed nuclear weapons and acting very belligerently most recently, the Japanese government is beginning to soften its stance against nuclear weapons. So that's another concern as well. At any rate, we'll have to see what happens, but I'm fairly reassured that the Japanese population has a strong conviction that they do not want to see this industry continue in anything like the guise that it has been previously.
Well, it's astounding to me that anyone in Japan would even consider reopening these reactors. They did get two reopened, as you say, after the four were lost at Fukushima, and then two more, units 5 and 6. Japan had an even 50 reactors that were licensed to operate. They managed to get two of them back on, but the other 48 are still shut. But I can't imagine in any political situation. I spent time in Japan. I actually wrote about Japan, about Fukushima in 1976. I had an article published in the Progressive magazine that mentioned, you know, this insanity that they were building reactors in earthquake zones washed over by tsunamis. This was not a big surprise here. They knew this was going to happen.
Let me just point out, however, that yes, it's true that they were building reactors in a very dangerous area, and you look in astonishment and say, why were they so foolish as to build them in such an earthquake-prone area? But the whole of Japan is really subject to seismic activity of various kinds. Look at even the mountain, you know, Mount Fuji is expected to erupt sometimes in the foreseeable future, because it erupted most recently about 300 years ago, and it appears that it's ready to erupt now. There's many signs that it's getting ready to erupt. So how many reactors are even within a 200-kilometer radius of Mount Fuji? There's at least a dozen. So there, but we have to look at ourselves as well, because we in the United States and Canada, why have we built so many reactors around the Great Lakes? Think about the problems they're having with the water right now at Fukushima. If such an accident were to happen around the Great Lakes, where would all that water be going? It'd be going right into the drinking water of 40 million people, which is we're not so bright either in terms of where we're putting our reactors.
And you look at, for example, the Davis-Besse reactor near Toledo, which has, the best that I've heard, is four cracks in the containment. Almost got eaten through by, I got very close.
Incredible.
Yes, and it goes on and on. Gordon Edwards, with the Canadian, the largest of the Canadian anti-nuclear groups. Are you officially anti-nuclear, Gordon?
Yes, we are, but we really have an educational role, and so instead of trying to communicate an anti-nuclear message, what we try and do is educate people about the facts from a critical perspective, and we're convinced that when people learn the facts, they can make up their own minds. So our general approach has been we assist communities, we assist researchers, we assist politicians to get good facts that they can build a case on, and to really come to grips with this issue. So we're more of a research, our mandate is basically to act as a clearinghouse for information for communities and all those concerned about nuclear developments all across Canada.
And give us your URL for your website again.
CCNR.org.
Okay, now let's go back to Fukushima. I want to talk to you on another show. We're not going to get to it this time. We only got 5 minutes left, so I want to really make sure we cover Fukushima. There is a debate going on about whether what really caused the disaster of Fukushima. There are those who are arguing that Fukushima was doomed once the earthquake hit. Now, we had a 9.0 earthquake in the vicinity of Fukushima. It was actually 100 miles away. We have reactors in the United States at Diablo Canyon, for example, in California, at Indian Point in New York, that are very, very close to earthquake faults that are more than capable of delivering a 9.0 shock. But then, of course, at Fukushima, we had the tsunami. How, in your understanding, how much of the disaster at Fukushima was caused by the quake, and then how much by the tsunami?
Well, it depends upon how you analyze it. Really, the tsunami, the main effect of the tsunami was to wipe out the backup electrical systems. So it means that you had not only was the off-site power gone by the earthquake, that knocked out the grid, so you didn't have any off-site power. However, they have a lot of internal standby generators, diesel generators and batteries and other things that can be used to generate electricity, to run the pumps to keep the reactors cool for a period of time. Now, the tsunami wiped out those as well by shorting them out, so there was no power at all. And it was that total blackout that led to the overheating of the fuel because there was no circulation of the water. And because of the fuel overheating, the zirconium reacts with steam to produce hydrogen. When it reacts with steam, zirconium takes the hydrogen out of the steam and takes the oxygen out of the steam and releases hydrogen gas. And so that hydrogen gas that exploded and blew the roof off those reactors was actually caused by the overheating of the nuclear fuel inside. Then
so really didn't have anything to do with the tsunami.
Sorry?
So what was the role of the tsunami?
The role of the tsunami was to wipe out the electrical supply that ran the pumps. And therefore, you see, if the pumps were running, that would have prevented the fuel from overheating. But once the fuel was overheating because of no circulation of the water, caused by no electricity, caused by the tsunami destroying the backup generators, then it was inevitable that these reactors were going to melt down.
But, at least the big but, how long would those generators have operated?
Well, that's the whole point. Arne Gunderson, who worked for 23 years in the nuclear industry, he says that, look, those reactors were doomed anyway because those backup generators would only have provided power for a limited period of time. And then they would have run dry and you would have had the same problem.
So even without the tsunami, if the grid had not come back to operation to supply electricity to Fukushima prior to the expiration of the ability of the backup batteries to provide power, this all could have happened without the tsunami.
It could have happened without the tsunami. That's right. But you would have had a little more time. You would have had maybe even a day or so to be able to react to try and get some kind of jury-rigged system of electricity supply. But they had no time at all.
Once the tsunami came in and
once the tsunami hit, they had no time. And they were out of time already.
The geniuses who built Fukushima put the batteries in the basement. That's true.
Had they even diversified, as Arne Gundersen, again from Vermont, who has done some wonderful work on this, and his Fair Winds site is very good to look at. He's got a lot of videos that are very informative. But he points out that even if they had diversified where they put these backup generators, some of them higher up, some of them lower down, they would have had some redundancy, you know. They would have been able to supply electricity for a period of time at least. But
right,
they put them all in the basement, they put all their eggs in one basket, and they were gone altogether.
And we knew about this. Everybody knew that Fukushima was in a disaster zone, in an earthquake zone. Hit by an earthquake 100 miles away. God forbid that earthquake had hit, you know, 10 miles away. That place would have been rubberized. Listen, Gordon Edwards, I'm going to have you back. We've been talking with Gordon Edwards. We'll talk about next time about thorium reactors, small modular reactors. God forbid, hopefully there won't be any more bad news to talk about from Fukushima, but that's a lot to ask for. We spent this hour at the Sports Happy Green Power and Wellness Show with Gordon Edwards. Thank you so much, Gordon, talking to us from Canada. You will be back with us, I hope, and talking about Fukushima. Check out my article, if you would, please, about what's happening in Fukushima. And let's just shut all these reactors down as soon as possible. Thank you, everybody at PRN. This has been another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.